Welcome everyone to the Strong Gravity Seminar. So the speaker today is Vishal Bhaipat. And Vishal is a graduate student from Johns Hopkins with Emmanuel Berti. I think today he will talk about the parents of LIGO black holes and their hometown. Okay, Vishal, please take it away. Yeah.
Okay, thanks for the introduction and thank you everyone for having me. It's a pleasure. I would have preferred to do this in person. I wanted to visit the perimeter for a long, long time. So I'm going to talk about this. Okay, just give me a sec. So I'm going to talk about this work that came out last year, plus some ongoing work as well. So, you must have all seen this. So LIGO has now detected around 50 binary black holes. And the first time I saw this image, I was both shocked and scared at the same time. Because, okay, this means that we have a full population now. We have a decent number of black holes, which means we can finally start answering some questions. So one of the questions that I want to answer is, where do these black holes come from? Now, we have some guesses. So for example, many of the stars that we see, they are in binary. So it's possible that you have two stars that are born together, they die together, they become black holes. There's some magic happens, and then they decide to merge. We call this magic the common envelope phase. The other option is that you have a stellar cluster with millions of stars. Some of them will become black holes. They come together in the center. They decide to pair up and finally merge, which is what LIGO might see. There are some other formation channels as well. But this is still a mystery where the LIGO black holes come from. Now, the hints towards solving this mystery, they lie in these observables. So the black hole masses, its distance, their spins. But if we look at most of the gravitational wave community, including me, so most of us, we try to focus mostly on spin compared to the binary masses or the redshift, because they are very, very complicated. For example, the binary masses, it depends on very complex stellar evolution. The redshift, it might depend on the redshift distribution. It might depend on still unknown the metallicity evolution with redshift. So most of us, we prefer the spins, and it can be seen easily. So for example, we can look at chi effective. So chi effective is the component of the black hole spins perpendicular to the plane. So for example, if you have two black holes that were born together, they should have spins in roughly the same direction, which means that the chi effective should be mostly positive. On the other hand, in a cluster, you have black holes that come from all directions. So you should have spins all over the place, which means that the chi effective, it should be symmetric around zero. So the idea is really simple. Let's look at the spin directions and we can find where the black holes, the LIGO black holes are coming from. But what if universe hates us? What if black holes have no spins? So if there are no spins, you cannot measure the spin directions. And that could very well be the case. So for example, there was this paper in 2019 by Jim Fuller, where he showed that most of the black holes, they're born with very, very tiny spin. Now, if there are no spins, you cannot measure the spin directions. And in fact, you cannot use this to measure the, let's say, the mixing fraction between how many black holes are coming from the field versus how many black holes they're coming from the cluster. So for example, we can just do a quick exercise. And if we assume that the black hole spins, they are sampled uniformly between zero to chi max, the accuracy of measuring mixing fraction, it goes like 1/chi max. Now, if let's say assume Jim Fuller is right and chi max is of order 0.01, in that case, if we want to measure delta F to the accuracy of 0.1, we will need more than 100,000 sources. We can do that with third generation, but of course, we don't want to wait that long. But there could be a silver lining to this. Now, this could mean that this is a very good news for, okay, Give me a sec so that you can see the full screen. I hope you can still see the full screen now. So yes, this means that if the spins are small, which means we could have a large number of repeated mergers. So when stars die, they become black holes. We call these black holes the first generation black holes. When they merge, the remnant is called the second generation black hole. Now this second generation black hole, it can decide to merge again, which could be seen by LIGO. Now these second generation black holes, they have quite unique characteristics. For example, they have masses that are twice the mass of their parents, and they have the spins which is peaked quite sharply around 0.7. Now, this makes them quite easier to identify. Now, the question is, where can we find these such repeated mergers? The answer is, of course, inside the clusters. So first, I'll talk about how clusters form, how we can form a second generation binary inside a cluster before talking about how we can use these second generation mergers to find the mixing fraction. So first, you have a cluster, you have millions of stars. Some of these heavy stars, they will run out of fuel in 10-ish millions of years, they will become black holes. Now these black holes are very heavy, in around 100 million years more, they will all sink to the center of this cluster. Now you have a core which is densely packed with black holes. Now we can talk about forming a binary. So one way to form a binary is via three body interactions. So in general, so you have a cluster where you have a bunch of black holes. Now these black holes, they have positive kinetic energy. If we want to have a binary, it means we need some negative binding energy, right? Which means, to form such a binary, we need three black holes. So what's happening in this case, this blue black hole is taking away some positive energy. And as a result, you end up with a binary of this red and blue, which has some negative binding energy. This is one way. The other way is through binary single exchanges. So everything that is heavy, it sinks to the core of the cluster. So what else is heavy besides black hole? The normal binaries. So you have a stellar binary. So what could happen is a black hole will come. So for example, in this case, it pairs up with the orange star before finally deciding to pair up with the blue star. So you end up with a binary of a black hole and a star. Now this thing can happen again. Another black hole will come and it will kick out the orange, the blue star in this case. So you end up with a binary black hole. But we are still not there yet. So for example, the separation between the binary that we just formed is of order of several astronomical units. Now, gravitational waves will never be able to merge this pair within the lifetime of the universe. So again, the three body comes to the rescue. So for example, in this case, we have a relatively wide binary, another black hole comes, and it takes away some more energy from the system. So which means that you have a system which ends up with even tighter black hole, even more negative binding energy. So this process happens over and over again, and more and more this lone black hole will come and will take more and more energy, and you will end up with tighter and tighter binaries till gravitational waves take over. But there is a side effect of this process. So the difference between binding energy between the initial and the final stage is basically transferred to the kinetic energy of the system, which means that this binary is going to get a kick. And actually you can show that the kick is inversely proportional to the square root of the separation. So with every encounter, the binary will get tighter and tighter, but it will also receive a larger and larger kick. Eventually it is going to get kicked out of the system, kicked out of the cluster. Now we want to form second generation black holes, which means we want this guy to merge inside the cluster. To do that, we can either get larger black holes, or we can either get larger clusters. So let's look at the timescales now. So for example, in this case, I'm plotting timescale as a function of cluster mass. So the upper panel is a merger of 10 plus 10 solar mass black holes. The bottom one is the merger of 50 plus 50 solar mass black holes. So the black is the total time it's going to take to merge to get a LIGO binary. And so, for example, let's look at the purple line, which corresponds to the how much time you take during the gravitational waves. So, for example, if you look at the smaller cluster masses, which have smaller escape velocities, in that case, what happens is that you do not spend enough time in the tightening phase, and the binary, it gets kicked out of the cluster pretty early on. So it spends quite a lot of time as emitting in the gravitational waves. But if you have, say, let's say larger clusters, the hardening process is quite efficient, which is the this dashed blue line. And you don't spend much time during the gravitational waves.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah, Bijal,
here in your plots, when you're considering equal mass mergers or equal mass binaries, is this a consequence or is this a pre-assumption in the sense that you think that the process of the binary exchange will eventually want to favor equal mass black holes, or is this an ingredient you're putting in?
Yes, of course. The clusters, they tend to prefer equalish mass ratios. But in this case, we're just trying to see what are the typical time scales. So even if, let's say, I were to have 10 plus 5, things would not change by a lot. I'm just trying to show scale.
Yeah, no, that I understand. I wanted to go after the comment you just made. So you that's a statement that, sorry, I don't know enough about this, that the cluster picture would tend to favor roughly equal masses?
No, so this is not what I'm trying to say here. So all I'm trying to say here is the different timescales. So
No, that I understand. I'm asking about the process of formation. So do you think that clusters,
they do. So for example, all we want is tighter and tighter binaries, right? So binaries which have very negative energy. So for example, in this case, it's equalish mass ratios, but let's say if they were very different black holes, what would happen is that the other black hole, if it had mass similar to, let's say, this guy, it would lead to an exchange. And over time, you would prefer binaries which have mass ratio closer and closer to one. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, thank you.
Can I also ask about, like, you know, the assumptions you're making about these clusters? You know, like, these masses seem quite large. I mean, 10 to the 8 for a globular cluster seems rather large.
Okay, so no, I am not fixing myself to 10 to the power to the globular clusters only. So yeah, everything out beyond 10 to the power 6 is nuclear star clusters as well. So we will not assume any supermassive black hole inside the nuclear star cluster. But yes, this range is basically nuclear star cluster.
Okay, so you're imagining nuclear star clusters. I see. And so typically, you know, like, you know, what sort of velocities are found in those clusters?
So you mean escape velocities, right? So few hundreds, actually. In globular clusters, you can expect them to be of order of 10 kilometers per second. But in this case, if it's at least few hundred kilometers per second.
Then think about, I guess, these nuclear clusters, you know.
Yes, I wish we could do that. But the problem is that the mass distribution is top heavy, right? So we will find more clusters which are lighter compared to the heavier cluster. So the distribution, it goes like 1 over MCL squared, where MCL is the cluster mass.
Right. But if the globulars all have like escape velocities of like 10 kilometers per second,
agreed.
They won't,
Yes. And I will.
They won't form then the binaries that you want to form, right?
So exactly. But there is a caveat that I will just discuss in 2 minutes.
Okay.
So are there any other questions? No. Okay. So I'm plotting. Okay. So the other thing that we should that is really interesting is, so for example, at for small clusters, most of the time is spent in gravitational waves. But for the larger cluster, most of the time is spent in the three-body binary formation. And that is because, okay, so we want to have a system with negative binding energy, but the velocity dispersion of the black holes, it is proportional to the cluster mass. So heavier the cluster, it means that the velocities that they possess is also pretty large, which means they have too much positive energy. And if you want to form a negative binding energy, it is harder and harder. So for larger clusters, you spend most of the time trying to form a binary. And I also discussed the binary single exchange process. And now this thing, it depends on what is the fraction of stellar binaries that are already in the core. This is something that we do not know. But even if, let's say, we become very optimistic and we assume that the binary fraction inside the core is 10%, and even in that case, we find that this is a relatively subdominant mechanism to form a binary.
Can I also ask about these nuclear clusters again? Sorry. So are their densities similar to globular cluster densities?
No, they're much more dense. They're much more dense. So I do not remember what the density scale is like, but you can have a look at our paper, and it's pretty given pretty early on. I can open up the paper later after the talk if you prefer.
Okay, sure.
So the density, I do not remember how it scales as function of cluster mass, but yes, the density is going to increase. Okay, so in this case, what I'm plotting is basically M1 equals to M2 as a function of cluster mass, and I'm plotting different time scales contour plot. But what is more important is that, so this white dashed line, now this means that everything towards the right and up of this dashed line, so all these binaries, they are going to merge inside the cluster, while everything towards this side is going to merge outside the cluster. So only these binaries, they have a chance of forming the second generation black holes. But again, we are in this dilemma because this happens for large cluster masses and large black hole masses. And both of these, they tend to favor the distribution, the observed distribution, they tend to favor the small cluster masses and the small black hole masses. So if the conditions are right, the merger is going to happen inside the cluster. But are we done yet? The answer is no. So we have one last hurdle, which is the recall that we get during the binary merger. So for example, in general, if you have two black holes that are not exactly similar to each other, then you can have a preferential direction in which gravitational waves are emitted. This means that by conservation of linear momentum, the black hole should get a kick in the opposite direction. And this could be very large. So for example, on here, this is the position of center of mass as a function of time. So red is before the merger, blue is after the merger. And after the merger, the system, it gets a very large recall. So for example, in this figure, this animation, the kick that the system received is of order of thousands of kilometers per second. And actually this thing is very sensitive to the spin of the black hole. So for example, even if you have very small spins, you can have the kicks which could be of order of few hundred kilometers per second. Now, most globular clusters will not be able to retain such black holes. So we need very massive systems in that case to retain such binaries. So the other message is that we need very small spins. So this is the silver lining I was talking about in the beginning of the talk. That is, if black holes, they do not have large spins, which means the kicks that they receive is also going to be small, which means that we have a larger fraction of second generation black holes. So
is that also true? Is that also true if the mass ratio of the merger is not 1:1?
Yes, exactly. So actually, if the, let's say if you have no, if the black holes are not spinning at all, in that case, the maximum recoil that you get is around 150 kilometer per second. And that happens around mass ratio 2 to 3, somewhere between 2 to 3. So yes, even in that case, we kind of have this disadvantage. But the good thing is that these, most of the clusters, they tend to prefer equal mass ratios, which is just something we discussed a few minutes ago.
So,
okay, go ahead.
On that, so how large is too large?
With respect to the kick, it depends on which system you're talking about. So for globular clusters, we should not get kick, which is more than of order few tens of kilometer per second, because that's what their escape velocity is. But for nuclear star clusters, we can, let's say, have few hundred kilometer per second.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, because if the thousands of kilometers, I mean, that requires
no one is
rather fine-tuned configurations, but the few hundreds, that's a lot, that's easy.
Yeah, that's something we can do. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Okay, so to sum things up, if this was too confusing, so here's the story. If you want to form a second generation black hole, first all the black holes, they come together during mass segregation. They decide to pair up either mostly by a three-body binary formation, then you have more dynamical encounters which try to harden this binary so that gravitational waves can eventually merge them. If we are lucky, if we have the right kind of first-generation black holes, and if we have heavy enough clusters, we might be able to retain this binary, and then the same process that happens again.
So, Ashley, can I ask? I mean, like, so this mass segregation process sounds like it's important for this to happen.
Yes.
And so presumably that'll happen on something like the relaxation time of your cluster.
Yes, kind of.
And it also sounds like this, I mean, like it also sounds like only nuclear star clusters are possible sites, because globulars are just impossible, it sounds like, from what you're saying.
No, even in that case, they can. So basically, I think it scales like relaxation times, the ratio of black hole mass versus the ratio of typical star mass, right? So let's say if, it is even doable for globular clusters. No, globular clusters, they can indeed form first generation black holes, but they have a harder time forming second generation black holes.
Sure, right.
So for example, let me go to this picture actually. Yes, so for example, in this case, the hard part is not the mass segregation, which is the red dashed line. The hard part is the gravitational wave part. So it is of order 100 million.
To get the binaries hard enough, don't you have to have, don't you have to have a high escape velocity in the cluster just to harden the binaries sufficiently?
Yes. So this is where basically this peak comes from, and this is where.
And so for globular clusters, their escape velocities are so small that it sounds like you will never harden the binaries enough to form binary black holes.
Yes, and this is what happens actually. A large chunk of them, they get ejected out, and this is what we are seeing here. And most of the time, so they have very relatively large separation, and they spend quite a lot of time. In the gravitational wave phase compared to other cluster masses.
Yeah, exactly. So it's right. Okay. So therefore, it sounds like the globulars, you're saying, globular clusters will be negligible compared to nuclear star clusters. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
For second generation black holes, yes. For example, in this case, the gray part is beyond the universe lifetime. So even in this case, there are these clusters. So clusters which are between 10 to the power something times 10 to the power 5 to something times 10 to the power 6, they can indeed form black holes that LIGO is going to see, but they will be first generation. I hope that answers the question.
And by first generation, you mean that they form, they form as some tight binary initially?
Okay, no, so first generation is, second generation is repeated merger. So the normal binaries, they're the first generation mergers. Okay, so what I'm trying to talk about is the second generation merger, which is the repeated mergers. And in repeated mergers, we need very large escape velocities, which is going to mostly happen for larger clusters.
Mm-hmm.
But globular clusters, if they are heavy enough, if you look at this, the sweet spot is 10 to the power 6 solar mass clusters, right? So they are globular clusters, and they can form LIGO binaries quite efficiently.
And the binaries form efficiently because the stars themselves are born on tight orbits?
So there are different competing mechanisms that hinder this, right? So for example, for lower clusters, it is the escape velocities. For larger clusters, it is the very high dispersion, which doesn't let you form a binary.
Mm-hmm.
So the 10 to the power 6 solar mass clusters, they are right in the sweet spot. So they have enough escape velocities of order of, I think, 30 to 50 kilometer per second. So they can retain most of these three body kicks that we were talking about. And they also don't have that large velocity dispersion, which prevents you from having forming a binary, actually.
Okay. Yeah. So why don't you go on? Yeah. Like we can talk maybe.
We can get back to this later on. Okay.
Yeah. Well, can I just ask?
Yes, of course.
So for this first generation, can you go back to that size?
Yes, sir.
For this first generation dry hole merger, right? Like, as this binary hardens, central mass will receive kicks, right? Like as the separation shrinks. So at some point, it will be just ejected. And then this thing will merge outside the cluster. Yes. I mean, is this information only in this plot? I mean, this plot only has time.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So this is what happens. Okay. So in that case, we should look here. So this is what happens for everything towards the left of this dashed line. Everything towards the right of this dashed line. So yes, hardening is decreasing the separation. It is also giving you the kick. But if we can have enough encounters that the separation is small enough that gravitational waves take over, in that case, gravitational waves are going to merge the black holes before another guy comes in and tries to kick this guy out.
Does
that answer the question?
Okay, thanks.
So finally we can form, if the conditions are right, we can form a second generation black hole. But next question is, how do we identify them? Now, I just discussed. So they have quite unique characteristics. They are twice as heavy as their parents, and they have spins that is sharply peaked around 0.7. Now, in that case, it makes it very easy to find them. But instead of talking about what second generation black holes can do, I will talk about what first generation black holes cannot do. And the first thing that they cannot do is they cannot have arbitrarily large masses. So for example, in general, in a star, there's a balancing game, right? So you have inward gravity versus outward radiation pressure. Now, if the star is large enough, the temperatures, they can be large, and we can have electron positron formation. And so the photons that were providing the outward push for gravity, they're not there anymore. So the star, it collapses, things go bad, oxygen, it starts reacting violently, and this eventually this star explodes and nothing is left behind, which is what we call pair instability supernova. If the star is not that big, in that case, the things are not that violent, but you still end up losing quite a lot of mass. So which means that there is indeed some limit on black hole mass. And this is what we call the mass gap. So, but the second generation black holes, they have no such restrictions. So for example, if the maximum is 45 solar mass limit on the black holes, you can have a merger of 30 plus 30, and the final product is 60, which lies somewhere inside this gap. So the answer is simple. If you have a merger which lies somewhere here, it should be a second generation black hole. And this is where exactly 1905-21 light. And I thought this was the end of the story, that and people would believe the 1905-21 is indeed a second generation black hole there, but that was not the case. It seems that you can play around with, let's say, convection and other stuff, metallicity, and you can even push this mass gap. So in that case, I will also talk about something that is spin gap. And this is not something that is well established. So in general, we expect that stars, they are spinning. So black holes, so when they die, they form black holes that should also spin. But that is not the case as was shown by this paper by Jim Fuller in 2019. So basically what he showed is that because of Taylor's Swift mechanism, there is some very efficient transport of angular momentum from the core of the star towards the outer layers. And when the star loses its outer layers, let's say when it's in red giant phase, it loses it most of its spin. So the black hole, basically you end up with almost zero spin. And this is what we have seen in LIGO as well. So for example, there was this detection, I forgot the phone number, but where the mass ratio was 10 and we could measure the spin of the primary. And the upper limit, the 95% upper limit on it was 0.067, which is of this order. Now this means if nature gives us non-spinning black holes, we can have something called as spin gap as well. This is not that well established. So for example,
Can I ask you something about this?
Yes.
So, I mean, of course, this is, you're talking about the core, but there could be subsequent accretion that spins
up. Yes, I agree. So I think, they don't share the accretion in this case, but you can also have, let's say, the tides, which is this green dot here. And then again, you can have some decent amount of spin. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you.
Okay, thanks.
Like how, I mean, is it just a crane or like, how confident are we, should we just trust this kind of 100% or?
Okay, so you mean the fact that the spins are almost zero?
Yeah.
I do not know. So these are basically, this is what you get from supernova physics. And I think if I remember correctly, this was pretty much independent of, let's say, other uncertainties like metallicity, etc. But I do not know how much we can trust this. But actually, this is what we are seeing as well, right? So, for example, if we look at LIGO binaries, most of them they have very small effective spins, and the other event that I was talking about, mass ratio 10. Where we could measure the spin of the primary. It was the upper 95% upper limit was 0.07 or 0.06, which is of the same order.
So on the other hand, we also see some of them do have spin. And this may also depend on mass.
Right? Like, so there was some disturbance.
The massive stars.
I could not hear you, sorry. Can you repeat the question?
Oh, I'm just saying the LIGO event, some of them, a small fraction.
I will talk about two of such events. Exactly, I'm going to talk about two such events. So, yes.
Bob, let me just interject one quick thing. Statements about the black holes being constrained, the spins of the black holes being constrained to very small values are strongly prior dependent. So a lot of the default priors that the LIGO-Virgo collaboration have published put a lot more weight at small spins a priori than they do at large spins. It has to do with the, particularly for the effective spin, it has to do with the assumptions about how spins might be, the angles of spins might be distributed. So statements like the chi effective is, constrained to be less than 0.1 or 0.0 something are probably strongly influenced by the prior rather than a clear signature in the actual likelihood. which doesn't necessarily have anything to say about the population sensitive stuff that you're going over, but I think it's important pointed out that the data is not actually that precise about spins.
I see. So yeah, I have another issue with LIGO price, but we can discuss this some other time. So yes, so in this case, what I'm talking about is basically, so let's assume that the maximum spin that black holes they are born with is 0.1, 10 times what Jim Fuller is saying. In that case, the first generation black holes, they are confined to a very tiny space in this plane. And most of the vast region in this plane is left vacant. Now, this means that next I can also show the distribution for first generation and second generation. Now, if you have 1G plus 2G merger, you get this banana. If you have 2G plus 2G merger, you get this upside down crown. Now, these distribution, the 2G plus 2G is very different from 1G plus 1G. The same goes here. So let's say if we get a binary that lies here, we should say that it should be a second generation merger. And 1905-21 lies exactly inside this region. So in fact, its median, it coincides with the densest region of the distribution that I'm showing here. So in my opinion, this is a very compelling evidence that 1905-21 is indeed a second generation merger. Now, using the semi-analytical model that I discussed earlier, we can even predict how many mergers that you should expect in the spin gap, how many mergers you should expect in the mass gap. So let's say if black holes do not have any spin, in that case, you should expect that the 5% of all the mergers, they should lie inside the mass gap that come from the clusters. And 15% of them should have very large spins. Now, I'm going to claim that if we can find how many events there are inside a given gap, either mass gap or spin gap, I can even find how many of them come from the cluster. So for example, let's say we know that the efficiency of getting a gap event from a cluster is 20%. And we see only one gap event out of 10. We can say that you have five binaries that come from a cluster, which means that the mixing fraction is 50%. So step by step. So first, we need to find the Chi-max of the 1G plus 1G population, because there are other uncertainties that are going to affect your efficiency, but no one is more important than the spin of these black holes. Next, using this Chi-max, we can calculate the efficiency. Then all we need to do is just find out how many events are there inside either the mass gap or the spin gap. And then we compare the predictions versus theoretical, and we can have the mixing fraction. So, and to what accuracy we can do this. So all we need to do here is just do a simple propagation error. So you have yet two kinds of errors, basically. So one is due to the fact that you cannot measure Chi-max accurately. And then the other is just the Poisson counting error, which the Poisson counting error, it dominates at large Chi-maxes. And that's because we don't even have enough events inside the gap. And how much time do I have? I have 5 minutes. And the efficiency error, of course, it dominates at the smaller Chi-maxes. Now, by the black line, I'm showing if we wanted to, the accuracy of measuring mixing fraction, if we only relied on the 1G plus 1G population. And as I discussed earlier, it goes like 1 over Chi-max. So if the spins are indeed small, we can just forget about using first generation to find the mixing fraction. In that case, the second generation, they are more reliable. And this is what I'm showing here as well. So for example, this is the mixing fraction scaled by the number of detection. Blue means that the errors are small. Yellow means the errors are large. Everything towards the right-hand side of these white dashed line, it means that we are better off using the first generation black holes to find the mixing fraction, while on the right left-hand side, we are better off using the spin gap or the mass gap. Now let's again assume that Jim Fuller is right and the Chi-max is of order 0.01. In that case, earlier, we were going to need 10 to the power 500,000 events to find the mixing fraction. But now we only need a couple of few hundreds, which should be possible in near future, actually. And let's switch gears. I'll quickly discuss this. This is something I'm working on these days. So let's say we are lucky and we can indeed find an event which is a second generation event. And especially for 1G plus 2G events, in that case, the mass ratios, they could be pretty large, and it could be easy to find the spin of the primary. And this is what we were able to do for 1904-12. And now there are many papers that say that 1904-12, it could be a second generation event, which means that this is a 2G black hole. Now, the question that I want to ask is, can we say anything about the masses or the spins of its parents? So in this case, I'm showing the distribution of the remnant for different mass ratios of parents, for different spins of parents. And this is the remnant spin. Now, so basically this is a distribution over different angles. So for example, on this end, you have both the parents, they are pointing up, while in this case, you have both the black holes that are pointing down. And we can actually invert this. So in this case, I am plotting this spin combination as a function of mass ratio. So let's say if we were to measure a remnant which has remnant with spin 0.69, this means that it should lie in this region. If the remnant had spin 0.5, it should lie in this region, the region marked by the black lines. Now, let's say we can have our own astrophysical bias that my Chi-max, it cannot be larger than, let's say, 0.1. Now, this means that the parent of this remnant, it should come from this tiny region. We can do this for 1904-12. Okay, we will not have any spin, any assumption. We assume that the spin prior is uniform between 0 to 1. And this is the result. So again, this shows that the apple does not fall far from the tree. The parents of the 1904-12, it also had relatively larger mass ratios. The primary, it also had relatively very small spins. And we cannot say anything about the chi2 because what we're measuring basically is chi tilde here, and it goes like Q square. So since Q is pretty small in this case, all we're measuring is basically the spin of the remnant. And I have just one minute. So in that case, if this is the take home message. So first, the spin gap, it's as important as the mass gap. And it can be very well be helpful in finding how many events that are second generation. And for the second take-home message is, for some lucky second-generation events, we can even find their parents. So I will just shut up and leave you with this. Thank you so much.
Okay. Any questions?
Yeah, thank you. I have maybe a left-side question here. So suppose I follow your argument, and you, mm-hmm. So you say, well, now in order to explain the event, you're looking at the parents favor slightly high mass ratio with low spin. So I'm trying to say, can you quantify how lucky this event it is? Why would it be natural to see events where the mass ratio would be closer?
Yes, so it all depends on whether we can find the spin of. This guy, and that is again yes, like you said, it's a question of the mass ratio and the spin. I do not know how do we define how can we separate this being lucky versus being unlucky. Yeah, I do not know the.
All right. Interesting. Thank you.
Actually, Michelle, you were kind of rushing at the end, right? Like,
my bad.
It's partially my fault. I told you it was 45 minutes talk plus 15 minutes questions, but it's flexible. So maybe so I don't quite get your last couple of slides. If there's no more question, maybe you can.
Yeah, sure.
Explain what you were doing. Yeah.
Okay, so in this case, what I'm doing, so basically in this case, this is a distribution of the remnant spin as a function of mass ratio and the two spins of the parents. So in this case, I'm assuming that the spins could be all over the place. So they are uniformly, they have uniformly distributed directions. And this is what the distribution it looks like. So the blue corresponds to the small mass ratio, green corresponds to more equalish mass ratio. And now we can invert this basically. So what we can do is basically,
what is chi r again? So
chi r is this guy. So let's say you have two parents, they merge, they have mass ratio something, they have spin chi 1 and chi 2, and the chi r is a spin of this black hole.
Okay.
And in that case, so let's say we know the chi r from LIGO. And then what can we say about the mass ratio of the parent? So Q is the mass ratio of the parent. Chi tilde is this combination of spins of the parents. So what can we say there? In this case, what this means is that, so for example, if chi r equals to 0.5, it needs to lie in this region. So it needs to lie somewhere here. If let's say chi r equals to 0.69, it means that equal mass ratio is favored. Equal mass ratio of the parents is favored. But let's say if chi r equals to 0.5, you will need relatively larger spins larger than 0.5, if you want to explain this chi r equals to 0.5. And again, so we can, if we have some astrophysical prior, let's say if we know that the black holes that cannot spin faster than let's say 0.1, then we are stuck to this very tiny region. But this is not what we did. We just assumed that these spins, they are uniform between 0 to 1. And then we ended up with this. So we employed whatever I was talking on, this event 1904-12. There are some papers that say that this event is a 1G plus 2G event. In that case, we are very lucky because we know the remnant spin. Now, what can we tell about the spin of the spin and masses of the parents? So this is the corner plot that I'm showing. So this is mass ratio. This is the 1D histogram of the mass ratio. And it is pretty small. So it peaks around 0.2. Can we say anything about the spin of the primary? The answer is again, yes. Even though the prior that we assumed was uniform between 0 to 1, it favors smaller spins for the primary. For the secondary black hole, we have no information because what we basically measure is chi tilde, which goes like Q squared times the chi 2. Now Q in this case is 0.2, which means the spin of the secondary black hole, it is not going to contribute. I hope this was more clear.
Yes. So for this to work, you're assuming that this first generation merger is with a line spins already?
No, we did not have any assumptions. We had uniform priors between for Q 0 to 1, for chi 1 0 to 1, and for chi 2 0 to 1. So we did not make any assumptions.
Yeah, so you have uniform prior for that, but you're assuming two spins are aligned during the merger. Did you make that assumption?
We do not make any assumption about the spin orientations either. So after all, this is a merger inside a cluster, right? So we cannot make any assumption that the spins are going to be aligned because in general, you expect the spins to be all over the place.
Okay.
Is there something on the chat?
I have a related question. So as you said, if one were to get some subset of events where the spin is pointing kind of in the opposite direction of the orbital plane, that would give you a very strong indication that was not coming from common envelope.
Yes.
But is it also the case that if you consider further generations, that you throw that out? Under the assumption that you had low spins.
Yes. Yes. If indeed for a second generation black hole, let's say if we were to get a very large, let's say chi p, very large chi effective, and it is negative, that is in my opinion, conclusive evidence that it is indeed a second generation black hole. But we have not seen anything so far, right? That very large precession and very negative chi effective, right? All we have seen is basically this event, 1905-21, which had zero-ish, which had zero-ish chi effective, but it was precessing quite fast. So in fact, if it had chi p, which was very close to 0.68, which is what the spin of the second 2G black holes are, right?
Yeah, but hold up. That's a statement about the prior on the spin again.
No. Okay. So in that case, if I remember correctly, actually, I have some plots I can show you later if you want. So I compared the priors of 1905-21 versus its posterior, and they were very different. So yes, I do not like the priors that LIGO uses because they have some peak around 0.2-ish, but that is not the case for 1905-21. In that case, the chi p, it was pretty large. And the same goes for actually 1904-12 event as well. In that case, we can definitely see that the posterior for chi p is quite sharply peaked compared to the prior.
Okay, I'm gonna have to remind myself of the figures. I don't want to hold up the discussion, but that is not my recollection. So we can talk later. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, sure.
So this 1904-12, why do you need to propose that one of the black holes is a second generation black hole?
This is not what I'm saying. Many papers, there are few papers that make this claim. All I'm trying to say is, let's say we are, if this is a second generation black hole, can we find its parents? And then the answer is yes. So there are some papers by Carl Rodriguez. I think it was either PRL or Astrophysical Letters. I forgot which one, where they made this claim, but this is a repeated merger. And then there was this another paper by Gerosa, Berti, and Vitale, which showed the same thing.
Sorry, this is the binary black hole merger. So I'm looking at the paper, LIGO paper. So M1 is like 32 solar mass, M2 is like 8 solar mass. Is that the system you are talking about?
Yes, that is the event I'm talking about.
So it's not in the mass gap. So it's not that.
No. These are two different events. So I'm talking about two different events. Sorry if this was not clear. So in this case, this event is 1905-21. This is the mass gap event. And then the other one is the event that you're talking about. That is not inside the mass gap. Yes. That is a different question. Sorry if this was not clear. I'm trying to answer. These are two different questions.
Okay. But the posterior seems you were drawing, which system you are referring to?
Okay, so give me a sec. Let me try to find, let me try to see if I have the plot. Sorry, they might not be neat, but let me see if I have the plots. Just give me a sec. Yes, I think I can share the screen again. So can you guys see this image?
Yeah.
So Okay, yeah, this is 1904-12, the event I was talking about. The yellow curve is the distribution, prior distribution, and then the blue one is the posterior. So in this case, we can definitely see that these two are very, very different. So we can trust this one. And okay, so these are other events. So in this, which case, prior is very similar to the posterior, but not for 1905-21. So 1905-21, the yellow is the prior, the blue is the posterior. They are very much different. So I think in this case, we definitely know CHIP. Yeah, this is another problem that I have with CHIP, because we do not know when it is exactly measured and when it is not. So there was a paper by from the Birmingham group where they tried to study this, but I do not remember what their findings were.
Okay. So is there any additional questions? Well, if not, let's thank Vishal.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me. We had a very nice discussion. Thanks a lot.